Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2005, the tribal elders of the Northern California Amamutsun Indian tribe came to a tribal council meeting and said, "We have to get back to caring for the land. Creator never rescinded our obligation to do that." According to Tribal Chair Valentin Lopez, saying no to tribal elders is not an option. So he quit his job working for state government to heed their call. Lopez and others are working to restore the diversity that once existed in their traditional territory, which stretches from Santa Cruz and Monterey up to Año Nuevo on the San Mateo coast and east to the Diablo and Gabilon ranges. The call paved the way for a collaboration between scientists, environmental advocates, and park officials to use the tribe's rich traditional knowledge to solve today's environmental problems and bring back the plants and animal diversity to the area. Historically, California Indians have used an array of sophisticated techniques, such as burning, pruning, and weeding, to direct animals and plants' growth and reproduction. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about how Native American traditions and knowledge are helping to restore California's ecosystem. And today we are joined by Val Lopez, chairman of the Amamutsun Tribal Band of Costanoan Ohlone Indians, which stretches from Santa Cruz to Monterey and inland to Mission San Juan Bautista. After 2.5 centuries of Spanish, Mexican, and American rule, only 600 enrolled Amamutsun members remain. The tribe is not recognized as a sovereign tribe by the U.S. government, and they're working to change that. And Val is working full-time now on bringing his tribe together. In 2012, he successfully petitioned the Bishop Richard Garcia of the Diocese of Monterey to apologize for the atrocities committed during the Spanish conquest. Val also teamed up with the University of California to reclaim knowledge of Native histories and plants. And Val Lopez joins us from Santa Cruz. Hi, Val. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, good morning, and thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. We are also joined by Mary Ellen Hannibal. She's an award-winning environmental journalist and author of The Spine of the Continent. Her new book, Citizen Scientist, Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction, will be published in September. And Mary Ellen has a piece out in Bay Nature called Rekindling the Old Ways, and you can find it at Your Call. Radio.org. And Mary Ellen joins us from Nashville. Hi, Mary Ellen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. So very pleased to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's so great to have you. So this is such a fascinating project. And Val, I want you to take us back to that day in 2005 when the tribal elders of the Amamutsun tribe, your tribe, came to a meeting and said, "We have to get back to caring for the land." What was your reaction, and what did that mean exactly?
Well, we had elders had requested to attend the meeting and to talk to us, and when they came in, you know, we talked about a number of things, about caring for our ancestors, you know, about taking care of the remains, protecting our territories from excavations and development, etc. But then when they said that that Creator never rescinded his obligation that we take care of Mother Earth and all living things, and we need to find a way to get back on the path of our ancestors, in all honesty, I left that meeting kind of just shaking my head and saying, I don't know how in the world we're going to ever do this. The majority of our members are very poor, living at or below poverty level. We own no land. We can't afford to, very few of our people can afford to live in our territory. Mm. And we lost so much of our traditional indigenous knowledge. And so that seemed like an impossible task the elders were asking. But because they asked, we had to find a way to fulfill that responsibility or that obligation that they gave us, that they reminded us of. And so that was one of just, you know, a lot of confusion, a lot of disbelief, but understanding that that was the right thing for them to ask us.
That is a pretty tall order, Val. How did you even begin down this path to try to bring the tribe back together, find the funding, the resources, the connections? Where did you start?
Well, you know, we talked about it in the tribal council, and you know, we talked about some possible ideas. A lot of it just very small things, like trying to find places to grow plants that would attract the butterfly, that would attract the hummingbird, that would attract bees, and kind of start there. And so we were, you know, trying to see how we could do that. And then about 5-6 months later, we got a call from the superintendent of Pinnacles National Park. And his name was Eric Brennerman, and he was new to Pinnacles. And he had transferred in from an area where he had great relations with the local tribe. And when he looked at the landscape of Pinnacles and stuff, he says, there has to be a Native American tribe tied to these lands. Who are they and where are they?
Wow. We're going to talk more about that, but let's step back, Val, and talk a little bit about the Amaw Mutsun tribal band of Costanoan Ohlone Indians. So the Amaw Mutsun is not recognized as a sovereign tribe by the U.S. government. There are only 600 enrolled members at the moment. First off, why isn't it recognized as a sovereign tribe by the government?
Well, let me give 1 minute of background history a little bit.
Sure.
At first contact, the central coast of California was the most populated of indigenous people north of Mexico City. So there was, you know, I mean, so the territory we're in had quite a few Indians. It's estimated that at first contact, and this is a very conservative estimate, we think it's 3 or 4 times this, but the most conservative estimate says there were 30,000 Ohlone at first contact. After the mission periods closed, less than 100 of those Ohlone that were taken to the mission survived. So our numbers just dwindled incredibly. And you asked about, you know, why we're not recognized today. It's important for people to understand that in 1851, our people, our ancestors, did sign a treaty with the federal government. Most California Indians signed that treaty in 1851. And it was going to give 8.5 million acres spread over 18 reservations of California to the California Indians. After those treaties were signed by our tribe and the representatives from the federal government, they went back to Washington. The treaties were sent to Washington to be ratified. The California legislature and the governor got together and passed a resolution asking the federal government to not ratify the treaties. And then, once that resolution passed, they sent a delegation to Washington to lobby the Senate and the president to not ratify the treaties. The President of the United States then ordered that the treaties be sealed for 50 years, which they were. And so we do not have federal recognition today, but we did sign a treaty, and that treaty was sabotaged by the government of California.
Mary Ellen, you wrote a great piece for Bay Nature about these issues, and you interviewed UC Berkeley archaeologist and California Indian scholar Kent Lightfoot, who told you about the Amaw Mutsun and other coastal Indian tribes that were impacted very, very hard by colonialism. Val was just talking about what happened to his tribe. What else did you learn from Kent about coastal Indians?
So Kent Lightfoot is a UC Berkeley archaeology professor who's long studied Native Americans, California Indians in particular. And another piece of the story that Val would tell also is that, and he'll remember what year this was, Kent Lightfoot had a student, Chuck Striplin, who was a PhD candidate in anthropology. And Chuck was looking for a project to do his dissertation on. And Chuck is from the Amamutsun lineage. So there's kind of, looking at this from the context of academia, there's a widespread understanding that, you know, we have messed up the way that Earth processes work today, right? We're, you know, in this Anthropocene moment where the way that we cultivate and make our food and our habitations, the way that we use resources, is not sustainable, and, you know, we're threatening ourselves with very dire results as a result of the way we do things. So there's a question, like, where did that start? Where did we kind of go wrong with how we're cultivating our use of natural resources. So there's great interest in how did Native American people live on the land for so long successfully. Now, there were very far fewer of them. It's not like it's a quid pro quo equal equation, but what Kent Lightfoot and Chuck Striplin and other researchers, including Rob Cottrell and Val Lopez, what they have uncovered is a style of managing the landscape and managing wild species that Native Americans did here, Californians, that did not domesticate the plants. So there was a wildness that was retained by the resources that were cultivated. So Kat Anderson's seminal book is called Tending the Wild, and there's a lot to that title. It's not making a garden. It's not domesticating sheep. It's actually keeping the wild wild. So this is of tremendous interest to scholars all over the world. The research shows that Northern California Indians were not farmers. So the traditional trajectory has hunter-gatherers becoming more sophisticated and becoming farmers and then domesticating animals and plants. And Thomas Jefferson, you know, pushing for manifest destiny, was pushing for that farming and that kind of cultivation to occur all through the West. You know, get your property and start cultivating it, start domesticating it. Hmm. So here is this line of people who were not doing that. They were not making the wild plants or animals dependent on humans for their life. You know, if we stopped cultivating those big cows that we have all over the place, you know, some of them would become feral and probably survive in some way, but they would not survive in the form that they're in now without human intervention. And the same goes for a lot of the plant species that we cultivate for our use. So this is a really tremendous game-changing insight. And Kent Lightfoot and Chuck Striplin, Rob Cottrell, Val Lopez, and others. Another person who needs to be really given a lot of credit is Mark Hilkema, who is a California State archaeologist. And I may be getting ahead of the story here, but it is Mark who figured out where Portola had made first contact with the Amamutsin. They were not called Amamutsin then. It was the Quirosti polity, a very strong polity. And right there in White House Creek in Santa Cruz is the remains of Casa Grande, what the Spanish called Casa Grande, which was a meeting house that the Indians used. I hope I haven't taken you too far.
No, not at all.
No,
it's really interesting because I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the research out there that looks at the Native American, California Indian, I should say, relationship to the land before the arrival of the Spanish colonists, because there's so much, you know, information. There's so many stories about John Muir setting foot in California in 1869, thinking that this amazing place was completely wild and completely untouched and pristine until the Europeans arrived. And then a lot of researchers are saying, well, actually, that wasn't the case because Native Americans were actually tending these lands before John Muir arrived. And then people take it to the next level and say, well, yeah, they probably tended part of the land, but there's no way they could have tended the entire state of California. So what does the research really tell us? And are people still learning about the past, Mary Ellen?
People are definitely still learning about the past and that question of, you know, what is the extent of this kind of cultivation that we have this evidence for? And I'll just tell you, you know, my previous book, The Spine of the Continent, is about conservation biology, and I've spent a lot of time with conservation biologists. And then this new book that is just about to come out about citizen science is slightly different than that. And so I'm doing this story, by the way, of the Amamutsin. So Kent Lightfoot Chuck Striplin come to Val Lopez, and they don't say, we want to study this land of yours. We want to do a doctoral dissertation and write an academic book about it. They say, we're really interested in investigating these questions. Will you do that with us, and what would you like to get out of this? So this is in the category of what some people call extreme citizen science, which is citizen science that is focused on indigenous people, or sometimes underserved people in urban areas who are not, you know, necessarily indigenous to their areas. But it is community-based, it's co-created, it's collaborative. It's not me researcher, you subject. It's like we are researchers together, and we're investigating something mutually. This is just this fantastic development in some kinds of science today, and it's really my favorite part of citizen science. So, you know, California is this incredible state, as we know, and if you look in, Bay Nature did such a beautiful job with this story. So there's this wonderful map that shows all of the different polities of the different tribelets that were in California at the time of first contact. And as Val mentioned, there were more people here in California than anywhere north of Mexico City. Hmm. And part of that is because we have this incredible Mediterranean climate. We have this enormously rich marine system. So we have all of these resources that are from the sea. And then we also have all of these resources that we can, you know, as you know, we have something in bloom here basically all year. It's not like the East Coast where everything goes dormant at the same time. So it's actually likely that a lot of California Indians did do this type of cultivation. But one of the most contentious pieces and one of the most interesting to researchers and most relevant to our situation today is about the use of indigenous burning to cultivate wild species. And maybe Val wants to talk a bit about what is indigenous burning and tell us how that stewards creation.
I'll be happy to. We saw fire, our people saw fire as a gift from Creator. It was a gift and it was a tool to be used to help manage landscapes. When our people would see a particular landscape, they would break it into 4, 5, or 6 different segments. And then each year they would burn one of those segments. And so segment one would burn year one. And that right there would generate great seed production because the fire is needed to germinate a lot of the wildflowers, a lot of the wildflowers that we see. Year two, you would get these shoots that would come out of the ground, and that was the preferred foods of the deer, of the elk, of the other large animals. Year three, you got a higher growth, and then that higher growth provided a number of things. It provided materials for basketry, for netting, for cordage, also for housing, for clothing, and it also provided cover for the wildlife like rabbits and squirrels and gophers and stuff like that, so that they had a place to hide from the predators up above. And so, you know, doing it this way right here, we were able to keep landscapes open, to provide the seeds that were needed by the birds and all other seed-eating animals and ourselves. At times, our diets were would be 40% seeds. And then, Creator said, it's your obligation to take care of Mother Earth and all living things, and that was our obligation. And so that's what we learned, that's what Creator shared with us, is how to manage the landscapes to take care of all living things in a sustainable way. And so that's what we did. Hmm.
And Val, how do you answer that question about the relationship between Native Americans and the land before the arrival of the Spanish colonists, especially when we're talking about people like John Muir, who believed that everything was wild and untouched until the Europeans arrived? I mean, there's so many different opinions about what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at our creation story, and our creation story takes place at Mount Umanum, which is one of the highest peaks in the Santa Cruz Mountains. There, Creator very specifically told us to take care of Mother Earth and all living things. That became our sacred covenant with Creator. And so for hundreds and perhaps 1,000 generations or more, our people studied and learned that and passed on the indigenous knowledge generation to generation. And so we learned how to take care of the plants so that they provided for a community. If you look at our native plants, they provided a community, including the fungi that grew there. They took care of the insects, of the birds, of the animals, and of people. They provided for a community. Whenever you see the non-native plants come in, they don't provide for a community. They take care of themselves only, and that's why we have fields and fields of artichoke, broccoli, etc. I mean, their only goal is to take care of themselves only. You know, if a bug or a weed goes in there, they bring out the pesticides and take care of it right away. But our people, they saw it, our botany as a community, and they took care of, you know, that was needed to take care of all living things. So, whenever we talk about John Muir and stuff like that, I mean, they come in and they have their vision. They want to bring their European traditions and the European ways, and also their plants and stuff like that. Whenever we drive down the freeway, whether it be 99, 101, Highway 5, when you look at the landscapes, what you're seeing is 96% non-native. Hmm. In California, there's only 4% native landscapes.
Only 4%?
Only 4%.
Wow.
So that's a big part of our efforts today, our tribe and our land trust, is to start to return and restore. We're restoring not only our tribe, but we're restoring Mother Earth, and we're restoring the native plants, and we want to bring back the wildlife as well.
And Mary Ellen, you write about this in your piece, that we tend to think of today's native plants as having evolved and grown in an area without human intervention, when in fact, California's, quote, native ecosystems had been actively managed by the native people for a very long period of time.
Yes, and to your point about John Muir, he does stand as kind of a symbol of a kind of blindness to the landscape that we're still kind of trying to get the blindfold off of our eyes. Now, by the time John Muir came to California, some significant reduction in ecosystem functioning had already occurred. First of all, there was the eradication of the beaver from Sea to Shining Sea that basically was responsible, the underpinnings for the founding of the United States of America and Canada. Now, we took all those beaver, every last million of them, millions and millions of them, off the landscape so that, you know, there was some beaver when John Muir was around, but beaver changed the hydrology of the ecosystem. They changed how water flows from through it. And so this reduced the resilience of the landscape to have no beaver. At the same time, there was this huge fur otter seal business going on, taking all of the sea otters out of the waters and absolutely decimating those populations to fuel a fad in sea otter capes. But they literally took out all of the sea otters. And then the sea otters have this forcing effect on the ocean ecosystem, and their presence actually helps keep the kelp forests alive and doing well. And then the kelp forests are actually habitat to all sorts of other species. And then to add on top of that, we're also busy taking out the whales at that time.
Mm.
And we didn't really get to really nearly extinguishing the whales until, you know, the middle part of the last century after World War II, but we were significantly reducing whales. Now, when you take these players out of the ecosystem, you change its functioning.
Just quickly, why did they want to get rid of the sea otters?
They were making money off of the sea otters. So, you know, you just have to imagine this is just a huge resource. It's the way we use oil today.
Mm.
And, in fact, it has a corollary, you know, purpose, because it kept people warm in a time when there was not central heating.
Right.
So it was just a huge business. And so the sea otters and the beavers were all harvested for their furs.
And Val, you wanted to jump in?
Yes, I wanted to just add to the list that Mary Ellen provided, and that is when you look at the cattle industry and the sheep and the horses and the pigs, etc. I mean, they wanted a large landscape, but they also brought in their grazing grasses from Europe, and that just smothered out the native plants. And then what they did is they did not want the competition, and so that's when they started killing the bear, the elk, the deer, etc. And tremendously changed the environment as well by eliminating higher chain of managing the landscapes and managing all wildlife.
Valentin Lopez is chair of the Amamutsin Tribal Band of Costanoan Ohlone Indians. They've got 600 enrolled members, and they're not recognized as a sovereign tribe by the U.S. government. Val quit his job in 2005 after working for the state of California for 28 years to work full-time to bring his tribe together and to help restore California's ecosystem with Native American traditions and knowledge. We're also joined by Mary Ellen Hannibal. She's an award-winning environmental journalist, and I hope you can take the time to read her really great piece in Bay Nature magazine called Rekindling the Old Ways. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. And like she said, that map looking at Native American tribes in California is just really beautiful and makes you think about a lot about what has happened in the state of California. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. Coming up at 11 o'clock in a half an hour, it's BBC's World Have Your Say. The British are going to try and explain to the rest of the world the United States gun laws. 11 o'clock this morning on World Have Your Say, half hour from now.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Salon's editor-in-chief David Daly will join us to discuss his new book, Rat Effed, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. He explores how Republicans are rigging democracy through redistricting. In 2010, they gained 700 new seats and set the stage for unprecedented gerrymandering. So we'll talk about their so-called Red Map program and what it means for decades to come. And then on Thursday, we will talk about the ongoing refugee crisis. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about how Native Americans in California are using their traditions and their knowledge to help restore our ecosystem. And this comes at a crucial time because of our drought, global warming. And we're talking about this with Valentin Lopez. He is chair of the Amamutsin Tribal Band of Costanoan Ohlone Indians. The tribe stretches from Santa Cruz to Monterey and inland to Mission San Juan Batista. After 2.5 centuries of Spanish, Mexican, and American rule, 600 enrolled members remain. They are not recognized as a sovereign tribe by the U.S. government. We're also joined by Mary Ellen Hannibal, an award-winning environmental journalist, author of The Spine of the Continent. Her new book, Citizen Scientist, Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction, will be published in September. We'll definitely have her on to talk about that. And I hope you can check out her feature in Bay Nature magazine called Rekindling the Old Ways, the Amamutsin and the Recovery of Traditional Ecological Knowledge. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We are talking about the ecosystem in our own backyard, and so many of us do not know this history. So if you have any questions about plants, animals, the land, we'd love to hear from you. As Val said earlier, only 4% of California plants are actually native, just 4%. So if you have any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. If you are a California native and you'd like to weigh in, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Val, I think history is just so important at a time when, you know, President Obama was just in Yosemite. And I was thinking of the museum, the American Indian Museum there. And they have a couple of panels about what happened to the Yosemite Indians, the Awanichi people. They've got a picture of one of the teepees that's lit on fire. But after the four panels, it just moves on to John Muir and Ansel Adams and talks about where we are today. And it doesn't really go into the history. And I think that's why this is so important. So what else do you want to tell us about what happened when the Spanish moved up and down Northern California and how that really affected the land?
Well, whenever the Spanish came and the priests, you know, the church had a huge impact because they came for conversion, and they wanted to turn us into Catholics, and it was either be Catholic or die. That was their approach, and so in our history, it shows that that at the missions there was slavery, absolute slavery. Once you came in, you could not leave, and you were a labor force, and you were forced to work. If you didn't work, you were whipped. You were tortured by being put into shackles or stocks, etc. But if you look at our environment, they also wanted to destroy our environment because they knew we lived off the land, so they wanted to change the environment so that we would have nothing to return to. We couldn't return to our villages and our plants, etc. And so they destroyed our environment as well. They came in and they thought everything in California was totally inferior to what was in Europe. Our plants, our animals, our ways of doing things. And so there was just a huge impact on just changing the environment of California and destroying our environment. They also destroyed our spirituality and our ways. And I'm kind of off point a little bit on this. I'm sorry.
But
the history is just one of just domination. They wanted to dominate the Indians. They wanted to dominate the land. They wanted to dominate everything here in California. And this was followed by the Mexican period. And under the Mexican period, they gave these huge land grants to people who were well-connected. And there was no labor force in California, but yet they wanted to, you know, their goal was to develop these huge ranches of horses and cattle and sheep and pigs, etc. And so the Indians, once again, under the Mexican period, and this is very seldomly told, that was a period of absolute slavery for the California Indians. And then came the American period. And the American period, one of the very first, the first State of the Union given by Governor Burnett said that there will be a war of extermination against the California Indians. One of the very first bonds that was issued by the state of California was for the purpose of exterminating Indians. In early California, there was they paid bounties of 25 cents to $5 for every dead Indian. They also had military excursions to go up and find Indians and kill them, and that bond raised $410,000, and the state government paid $1.7 million to exterminate California Indians, and then they submitted that bill of $1.7 million to the federal government, and the federal government reimbursed California for the extermination of Indians. They passed laws of indentured servitude, which is slavery. In California, it's documented that some Indians were indentured into the 1930s. So we had Indian slavery in California into the 1930s. They passed laws to legalize kidnapping, and it was mostly children. They would kill the parents, or they would just take the children and sell the children. Boys would sell for $150, and girls would sell for $300. And it kind of goes on and on, but...
Right.
It's not, you know, I mean, it's a very difficult history that has never been told. And
that is why we do these shows, because it's so important. I mean, even California's first governor, Peter Burnett, famously said before the legislature in 1851, quote, "A war of extermination will continue to be waged between the two races until the Indian race becomes extinct." End quote. Mary Ellen, what I find so fascinating is that so many new books are being written about this. And as you said, so much new research is being done specifically about this topic, about Native Americans using their knowledge and traditions to restore California's ecosystem. We're in the middle of a really interesting time right now.
We are. I mean, it's really pretty fascinating. And part of it is really that we're understanding how blind our own history has been, and that we did not see at all, you know, what was here and how it was functioning, and had this, you know, incredibly, as Val pointed out, you know, Eurocentric idea that the wilderness was made by God and people had nothing to do with it. And then the first people to arrive were the Europeans. I mean, the utter incredible, you know, horrible colonialism doesn't get much worse than the California Indian story. And it, Val is right. You know, this is a genocide that occurred that has not had its due at all in our American consciousness. But part of the reason that we're so interested in this research is really to find a way forward for ourselves. Mm. And a point, a really, you know, salient point is about fire. So I was talking a couple weeks ago to Hugh Safford. He is a Forest Service forester, and he's a fire expert. And he was saying that when the East Coast foresters came out to the West Coast, he said they fell on their knees before the gigantic trees, the likes of which they had never seen. Mm-hmm. They had never seen forests that were like the forests that we had in California, and which we largely do not have anymore. Mm. And part of what was going on is that the California Indians were doing these low burning, and they were keeping the forest thinned. But when you do a low-intensity burning, big trees don't burn. So they would cultivate some big trees, and those big trees were, you know, once a tree is about 100 years old, it's usually pretty survivor-friendly and has roots deep, deep, deep down to get water out of the aquifer, even in droughts. Of course, we are pressing our luck on that one right now. But then there would be all this cleared space, And as Val described, this successional, one succession of another of different kinds of cultivation would go on through the burning. Now, so the Spanish come in, and the first thing they do is forbid the Indians from burning. And here's an irony. One of the ways that we know what California looked like at first contact is that the Spanish kept incredibly fastidious notes of everything that they saw. So Father Juan Crespi kept an incredible expedition diary. He came with Junipero Serra, and he describes miles and miles and miles of wild flowers, and he documents seeing burning all over the coast. So we know that wildflowers were here in 1769, mm-hmm. in a way that they simply are not here anymore. And burning, low-intensity burning, does encourage the growth of succession of wildfires. Wildflowers. So the Spanish come in, they stop the Indian burning, then this horrible, you know, period ensues with the American period, and the Indians are just in the way of people wanting to claim their land, pure and simple. And then the U.S. Forest Service becomes established and looks at fire as only bad. And part of the reason is that there was a lot of fires. San Francisco burned to the ground 6 times before the 05-06 earthquake, because, you know, there was just, everything was made of wood, and it was kind of a Wild West time. So it looked like pure destruction. And we have suppressed fire on our landscape all that time. It's been a couple hundred years of fire suppression. So when you go out and you see even Kurosti, which, you know, to me, the first time I went out there, I'm like, oh, this is so beautiful. It's so lush. It's so green. Well, it's a tangle of invasions and small trees. Now we have this problem where our forests have smaller trees that grow up and they take up too much space, so none of them can grow up into really big trees. They compete with each other. They also suck up a lot of water. They suck up more water, paradoxically, than when they were burned and cleared out and a couple of big trees were cultivated. So now, you know, we're stuck with something. And by the way, Yosemite is a good place to see it. When you drive into Yosemite, you will pass mile upon mile of dead trees. Mm, and they're taken out by pine bark beetle, but they're drought-stressed. Also, when you go to Yosemite and you go to that place, it's looking down on a valley that is where Yosemite was, quote-unquote, discovered by U.S. Army cavalry. The description of this beautiful, open meadow is what you have, that's what you read the description saying, what you're looking at. But what you're actually looking at is a forest, because the fire was suppressed. So right there in Yosemite is a piece of evidence that this landscape has changed since these white people came. Mm. But now we're really stuck because how can we, you know, it's so dry, all the trees are drought stressed, it's very controversial to do low intensity burning, although the Forest Service by and large wants to do it, knows it has to be done. They also want to clear out some of the excess, what they call excess, you know, smaller trees, and clear the forest. And this is very controversial, partly because when they have proposed to do this before, they said they were doing it for good reasons, but they also harvested big trees to sell to the timber industry. So, you know, the environment is just always in the crosshairs of our economic life. And when there's a buck to be made, the environment is just absolutely sacrificed. And now this is what we are paying the price for. We can't do that anymore. We have to figure out another way of relating to these natural resources. And that's where I think, you know, Val emphasizes this word stewardship, you know, and he's said to me a number of times, Mary Ellen, you're always talking about science, but it's really about stewardship. And I finally had to sit myself down and say, I don't think I'm really taking in what that word means. That word means caring for the natural resources. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just exist side by side with it and expect them to yield for you. You have to help them. You have to do something on behalf of nature. And this is, of course, why I love citizen science, because it gives you things to do to help nature and to help you learn about it and be in it. So that's all really great. But, you know, we are suffering in the past a drought like we're having. The forest would be able to withstand it much more easily because the trees were adapted to those droughts, and they got that way by being cultivated in large part by native Californians.
Mary Ellen Hannibal is an award-winning environmental journalist. She has a piece in Bay Nature magazine called Rekindling the Old Ways, the Imam Mutson and the Recovery of Traditional Ecological Knowledge. We're also joined by Val Lopez. He's chair of the Imam Mutson Tribal Band of Costanoan Ohlone Indians. They've got 600 enrolled members after 2.5 centuries of Spanish, Mexican, and American rule, and the Imam Mutson is not recognized as a sovereign tribe by the government. Val decided to quit his job working for the state of California after tribal elders came to a meeting in 2005 and said, we have to get back to caring for the land. And Val says, you just can't say no to tribal elders. So this is now Val's mission. And we've got a little bit of time left. If you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about this, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can tweet us at yourcallradio. So Val, why don't we talk about the efforts that you've embraced. You're working with young people. Tell us about what you're doing to try to effectively use some of these older traditions.
Okay, I'd be happy to. In 2012, we developed the Imam Mutson Land Trust. Our land trust is designed, the goals of our land trust are preservation and protection of our traditional tribal territories, particularly our sacred and cultural sites. Research and education, and that's why we have a strong relationship with UC Berkeley and others, and stewardship. With our stewardship program, what we want to do is we work very hard to restore the traditional knowledge of our ancestors. We say our ancestors, you know, they're on a path of taking care of Mother Earth, and that still remains our responsibility, but the journey of our ancestors wasn't done, and it's our job to get back on the path of our ancestors and to continue that journey. And so that's what our stewardship program is all about. So we work to restore a lot of the indigenous knowledge about how to take care of the basketry plants, our medicine plants, our food plants, our plants for special purposes such as cordage and netting, traps, etc. So we work to restore that knowledge. But a big part of what we teach and what we strive for is our ancestors, they had relationships. They had a relationship with Mother Earth. And so we're working hard to teach our members how to reestablish that relationship, to be able to listen to the plants, to be able to talk to the plants, to understand them, and how to care and take care of them, knowing that the plants themselves will take care of us if we can successfully restore that relationship. We look at all living things as our relatives, you know, so therefore the rivers, all waters, the air, the plants, the wildlife, the fish, the birds, they're all our relatives. And so we take care of them as our relatives. Imagine if everybody treated Mother Earth as a mother or a father or a brother and or a sister and treated it with love and respect and care. That's the way we take care of Mother Earth. The other thing that's important for us is the spiritual part of it. Our people were very spiritual, very prayerful. Whenever they would go to harvest the plant, they would talk to the plant and thank the plant for giving its life to feed us, to nourish us, knowing that whenever we died, that our remains would go back into the earth and nourish the plant in return. And whenever we took a deer or took an elk, etc., we had the same thing. We had prayers and made offerings and gave thanks to it. But then along those spiritual lines is we develop prayers, songs, and ceremonies that were important. Our people would have prayers and songs, for example, to call back the salmon, have prayers to call back the migrating birds, have prayers to the four directions to keep balance so that we have the right balance of summer, of spring, of winter, and fall, because they knew that too long of a summer or too long of a winter was not good for all living things. And so we had a lot of ceremony there, and our people would go to the mountaintops, because at the mountaintops is where you're closest to Creator. And so they would go to the mountaintops to pray and to hold ceremony, etc. So a lot of folks do not recognize the importance of prayer and ceremony in taking care of the lands. But that is exactly what we're trying to teach our stewards, so that they can carry on the tradition and pass it on to their children and other tribal members. And not only tribal members, our stewardship program is designed for to teach other tribes, if they're interested, in how to restore the indigenous knowledge to take care of Mother Earth, and also the non-native community. So for that reason, we have that strong education component, mm-hmm. where we're teaching a lot of folks who are interested in learning how to take care of the plants and how to take care of the environment and understanding what the plants have to offer us regarding food and medicines, et cetera.
Do you think that it's possible to bring back a decent percentage of that diversity?
Well, our tribal goal is to restore Mother Earth back to its pre-contact state. And we know that that can't happen or probably will not happen, but it remains our goal. And we say it took us 7 generations to get where we are today. So we hope that within 7 generations we can have it restored quite a bit, as much as possible, to what it was, so that we have those relationships, so that we have we were able to restore the native plants, be able to restore the fish back to the creeks where they belong, be able to restore the salmon so they have places to go up the river to spawn, you know, to have the migrating birds come back. Whenever we were when I can remember as a child, we'd see just huge flocks of geese coming north or going south and stuff like that. You just don't see that anymore. And that's what we want to do. We want, you know, within 7 generations, we have no doubt that we'll be much better off than we are today.
Val, we have a couple comments from listeners on email. Howard says, "Thank you from the bottom of my heart for this show. This is the wisdom we need to see ourselves not as having dominion over nature, but as being the caretakers of Garden Earth, standing side by side with all creatures." Beautifully said. Thank you, Howard. And Gina from El Cerrito says that she's got a tourist friend coming in from Sweden next week, and they were going to take her to see John Muir's home in Martinez. But she says, in light of what I'm learning about on today's show, we should reconsider, should we reconsider simply accepting the fact that we're going to learn what California school children learn in school. So, Val, do you have any suggestions for people where they can take friends so they can get a more complete picture?
Well, Boy, oh boy!
I have an idea.
There are a number of places. We like to learn about the plants at UC Santa Cruz. We have Amamutsen Garden at UC Santa Cruz at the Arboretum there, and they can go there and learn about native plants.
What about learning just about California Indians?
To learn about California Indians?
Or Mary Ellen, do you have any suggestions?
Well, you know, I would like to say, let's, you know, John Muir, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater on John Muir. You know, he's important for us to understand because we are him in many ways. So he's not evil and bad. He's a man of his time. Mm. He did do a lot for nature in California and for the idea of wilderness. We're still talking about him, and I think that's, you know, he's giving us a way to talk about these issues. So I think he's an interesting person to go and even see his house in Martinez. Then, yes, go to the Santa Cruz, University of California at Santa Cruz Arboretum has a quote-unquote relearning garden, and it is planted basically as a California native ecosystem would have appeared. Then you can also stop at Pie Ranch in Pescadero. You can buy a very good piece of pie or a whole pie there. But the owners of Pie Ranch do some work with Val and the Amamutsen and have planted a big space with some of their traditional plants out back of the farmhouse. And so you can go see that.
And there's also a great little museum in Mendocino that talks about California Indians. If you need any information about that, just email us, and actually we'll put a link on the website. Mary Ellen Hannibal is an award-winning journalist. You can find her story at Bay Nature Magazine, Rekindling the Old Ways. Valentin Lopez is chair of the Amamutsen Tribal Band of Costanoan Ohlone Indians. Find more information about what they're doing and maybe how you can support them or get involved, yourcallradio.org. Mary Ellen and Val, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us. And I also want to give thanks to Bay Nature for the article that they've written. And I want to recognize the Yamalu people upon whose lands your station is broadcasting today.
Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, David Daley discusses his new book, Rat Effed, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. In 2010, Karl Rove wrote, "When you draw the lines, you make the rules," and it worked. Republicans gained nearly 700 new seats and set the stage for unprecedented gerrymandering. Their Red Map program has radically altered the country's electoral map. So what are the implications for decades to come? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Tune in for Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
Coming up, philanthropy. Help or hindrance?
Where would we be without philanthropy?
Perhaps a step closer to realizing how empty and venal our political systems are and doing something about it.
Oh, think of all the good that philanthropists do.
Philanthropy is just the public relations arm of destructive capitalism.
What a Scrooge.
Philanthropy. Help or hindrance? On Philosophy Talk, Tuesday at noon on KALW 91.7.
Elements are forever, right? But what about the fact that microscopic creatures sucked up half of Earth's atmosphere 3.7 billion years ago?
And they think that one of the very early inventions of life was to be able to grab this very unreactive molecule, nitrogen, out of the atmosphere and build it into proteins.
The surprising ebb and flow of the elements on Big Picture Science.
1 o'clock this afternoon here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. The time is 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Rahul Tandon. Welcome to World Have Your Say. Will America ever change its gun laws?
Let's put aside the gamesmanship and come together to get a proposal that will be effective and get a result for the American people.
The American Senate has refused to change the country's gun laws. They've rejected four proposals to restrict gun sales following the shootings in Orlando. So what will it take to change those laws? And today, the International Olympic Committee have told Kenyan athletes they have to prove they're not drugs cheats if they want to compete at the Rio Games. What's gone wrong in one of the powerhouses of African sport? Get in touch with your comments. Send them in via WhatsApp, Twitter, or search for BBC World Have Your Say in your Facebook app.